The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Margie Weingarten, and I'm proud to represent my father, Ellis Wax, in whose honor my family created an endowed lecture. Before we get to tonight's author, I'd like to take a moment to highlight the library's digital collections. From medieval manuscripts to online exhibitions on the Civil War, our digital collections are engaging and available to browse anytime online. To help support the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation, please visit freelibrary.org/support. Now, let's focus on tonight's guest, John Meacham, a highly regarded commentator on history, politics, and religion in the United States. Mr. Meacham is executive editor at Random House and co-anchor of Need to Know on PBS, a popular presence on Morning Joe, as well as the former editor of Newsweek, where he started as a writer in 1995 and was appointed editor in 2006. His best-selling biography of Andrew Jackson, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, won a Pulitzer Prize in 2009. In Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, Mr. Meacham's most recent biography, the third president of the United States is portrayed as an artful politician. The Associated Press calls The Art of Power fascinating and insightful. Many books have been written about Jefferson's life, but few have created such a vivid portrait. In the New York Times Book Review, Meacham is described as belonging to the flawed giant school, whose other members include Walter Isaacson and Jonathan Alter. These journalists-turned-historians present their subjects as figures of heroic grandeur, despite all-too-human shortcomings, and so speak directly to the current moment, with its diminished faith in government and in the nation's elected leaders. Few are better suited to this uplifting task than Meacham. So please join me in welcoming John Meacham.
Hi. Thank you. I like to be uplifting. Sometimes. I'm an Episcopalian, which there are six of us left. And so uplifting is kind of tricky for us. I'm honored to be here with the Wax family. My middle name is Ellis, and it may be some nepotism. I leave it to you at the end of the evening to decide whether that's true. But the most important man in my life was named Ellis, my grandfather, Ellis Kirby Meacham. And so I am delighted to be here. I probably should not mention this at this point, but my branch of the Ellises were Tories during the war and went to Nova Scotia, so can't have everything. Since we're here, I wanted to do something I don't usually do and just read a paragraph or two, and then we'll talk about Mr. Jefferson. This is, it was Sunday, June 11th, 1775. That Thomas Jefferson came to Philadelphia from Williamsburg. And so let me just set a scene here in your fine city. Lodging on Chestnut between 3rd and 4th Streets, where the Continental Congress was meeting at the Pennsylvania State House, later known as Independence Hall, Jefferson effortlessly entered the flow of things. He sent accounts of the military situation to Virginia. He looked over Benjamin Franklin's proposal for, quote, Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. He recorded the financial and military estimates for continental defense. In a way, he had been preparing for this hour and for this work since he first stood in the lobby of the House of Burgesses in Williamsburg, listening rapt to Patrick Henry a decade before. There had been glittering evenings in the Lieutenant Governor's Palace, full of music and ideas, golden years in the Wythe House, his legal tutor, immersed in law and history, the apprenticeship in politics under Peyton Randolph in the Raleigh Tavern, watching and learning. The Jefferson style, cultivate his elders, make himself pleasant to his contemporaries, and use his pen and his intellect to shape the debate, armed him well for the national arena. He was no longer in Williamsburg or Richmond, but in Philadelphia, he felt at home. And he did. And he did pretty well here. Wrote a pretty good piece. Still talking about it. Jefferson in Philadelphia, interestingly to me, is a critical way station for Mr. Jefferson. He began his life as a political apprentice in the most fundamental sense. He was the eldest son of landowning, slave-owning Virginia gentry. Now, if you were to have fate deal you a hand in the middle of the 18th century in the colonies, Thomas Jefferson got a pretty good one. He was rich. He was the master of his domain in literal senses. And he was born in many ways for the roles he took on. It would not have occurred to him, actually, that he was not expected to go into public service and to rise to a position of authority and power. That was simply the air he breathed. His father was a tall, heroic figure to him, Peter Jefferson. He was a surveyor and an explorer. He drew the boundary line between Virginia and North Carolina, broken away from his fellows and ended up killing animals and eating them raw in the woods. Now that would just be called organic. So that's, the Jeffersons were always ahead of the curve. The Jefferson, that we know that story, means that Thomas Jefferson told it a lot. One of the things that's fun about what I'm able to do is if a story comes down in a family, if there's some stray detail that's odd, it's because it mattered to somebody, mattered enough to repeat or to put down. And so Jefferson expected, wanted, longed for political power. My argument in this book is that Thomas Jefferson wanted us to see him as a man of ideas. The tombstone at Monticello, author of the Declaration of Independence, author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, founder of the University of Virginia, is one of the great acts of misdirection in American history because it sends us off into a realm where it's kind of hard to get up a caucus against equality, liberty of conscience, and enlightened education. Right? That's not going to be contentious. The full application of those things always will be. But what Jefferson did is he sent posterity in the opposite direction of what he had done for 40 years. From 1769, when he was 25 years old, until 1809, when he left the presidency, a week after Madison's inauguration, he was a working politician. His job, his task, his mission, a lot of committee work, was to put together working coalitions to win certain points at a given time for a certain amount of time. And one of my many character flaws is that I like politicians. I like people, I salute people who are willing to put up with the slings and arrows of public life in order to try to make things a little better. And so there shouldn't be any shame in a long political career. And as our psychiatrists would tell us, the thing you don't mention is often awfully important. And so the fact that he did not mention his political career suggests to me that there's something there. So that's where I started with this. I thought that in the middle of the century, we had too much Jefferson veneration, broadly speaking, in the historiography. I was in Los Angeles last week and Bill Maher was interviewing me. You can imagine how, you know, well our ecclesiastical conversation went. He was late, and so I told the group that he was at choir practice. But I began a sentence saying, well, historiographically, and he said, please don't ever do that again. But historiographically, Jefferson was put on a pedestal in the middle of the century. He was literally put on one on the tidal basin in Washington on his birthday, on bicentennial of his birth in 1943. Then came the rise, thankfully, the rise of scholarship and cultural awareness and a new appreciation of the voices and lives that had been excluded from the mainstream narrative of our national history. And Jefferson had a pretty rough time of it and continues to in many quarters unto this hour. He became Jefferson the hypocritical slave owner. Then he became Jefferson the hypocritical slave owner who had an affair, had a children with his enslaved mistress. And that became a predominant part of the popular reaction when Jefferson's name was mentioned. So the reason I wrote this was my own belief that we're all more complicated than we seem, and that we can learn best from figures in the past when we appreciate in equal measure their vices and their virtues. It is much easier, I believe, and much more useful to look someone in the eye to make sense of them than to either try to look up at them on a pedestal or look down at them as if we're morally superior. And so this book is my effort, however feeble, to look Jefferson in the eye. So I want to talk about three things. Even though Jefferson thought the Trinity was the mere abracadabra of men calling themselves the priests of Jesus, which was a big, big seller in Sunday school in Virginia in those days. I want to talk about how he represents the best of us and the worst of us, and how I think there are some, this is a little overly reductionist, but there are some principles that come out of his political career that I think are worth thinking about right now and in any age. So we had him in Philadelphia in 1775. I'd like to take you in your mind, if you would, to New York in 1790, new capital of a new republic. George Washington has become president on the 30th of April, 1789. Jefferson has come back from France. He arrives back in Virginia, lands at Norfolk. There are rumors that he has been appointed the first Secretary of State. The letter from Washington finally catches up to him on, as he's heading home up to Monticello through Virginia. He has a sort of a Cincinnatus-like dance of the Seven Veils with James Madison. I want to talk about Madison in a moment because I think Madison is the most unappreciated political spouse in American history. He was Jefferson's political spouse in so many ways. He gets the letter, decides to do it, goes to New York. Can't find quarters, as he put it, on the Broadway. So he takes rooms at a house on Maiden Lane and immediately goes to war with Alexander Hamilton. They are, as Jefferson says, daily pitted in the cabinet as two cocks at each other's throats. Washington becomes tired of this. So the president writes a letter to both men who says, and the letter says, how unfortunate it is that whilst we are encompassed on all sides with insidious friends and avowed enemies, that internal dissensions should be harrowing and tearing our vitals. It's an interesting phrase, harrowing and tearing our vitals. It's particularly interesting for Washington because it's memorable. There's that. He was many things, but a phrase maker he was not. Here's how well that plea for unity worked. Jefferson wrote back about Hamilton, the illegitimate son of Nevis, I will not suffer the slanders of a man whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the very liberty of the country, which has not only taken him in and given him bread, but heaped its honors upon his head. Hamilton responded that Jefferson was a fanatic in politics and an atheist in religion, and an anonymous letter writer wrote to Jefferson, "I think you ought to get a damn kicking, you redheaded son of a bitch." So the Washington Dr. Phil sit-down intervention, not a big moment, not a big moment. Not a lot to learn for Speaker Boehner right on that one. I tell that because, as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And partisanship is a perennial force in our lives, in our political lives. It can be no other. Jefferson and others, as you all know, thought for a while that there could be, to coin a phrase, a post-partisan era. By the middle of Jefferson's presidency, he'd given up on that. And predictably, he blamed the other team. He said that I tried to have an amalgamation of parties, but the Federalists were like the incurables in a hospital and wouldn't let him do it. But early on, in the 1790s, there was still some hope. Washington, of course, warned against the spirit of faction in his farewell address. But Jefferson acknowledged, ultimately, that men have divided themselves into parties by differences of opinion of whether the interests of the many or the interests of the noble should prevail, since those questions convulsed Greece and Rome. So he looked all the way back. And in the same way, in many ways, that we look back to the events that unfolded so much in this city, in an attempt to get some bearings about where he was. So there are perennial forces, but Jefferson's was a particular life. And it's the particular life that we have to talk about in context, because to rip him out and act as though he could wander around and talk to us is ahistorical and a chancy exercise at best. I think we are here talking about him, though, because he represents the best of us and the worst of us. I think he represents the promise of the country, the promise of achieving a level of inclusive diversity and individual liberty that the world's never known. And he is representative of the worst of us, and I think we intuitively know this, because he was totally complicit in America's original sin, in slavery. And so I want to talk about the best and then the worst. He represents the best of us not only because he also was a man of enormous Renaissance interests. You know, he loved wine, women, song, art, architecture, gardening. He's actually kind of annoying that way. This is one of the few audiences perhaps in the world where I can make the following remark. President Kennedy, of course, the great line, the Nobel laureates are there, the White House, Kennedy says this is the most formidable gathering of talent since, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. What I say is that this may be the most formidable gathering of talent with the possible exception of when Annette Gordon Reed dined alone, who is just a brilliant historian and wonderful. And the Renaissance question, the Renaissance capacities of Jefferson are more than icing on the cake. It's more than an extra snack. It's absolutely essential to who he was politically. What he was doing, what a lot of the founders were doing, was trying to take developments in the life of the mind and give them political and cultural manifestation that would undergird and make possible a genuinely successful republic. When we think back at how immensely exciting it must have been to be alive then, because century upon century upon century of princely and priestly authority, where princes and prelates told you what to believe, told you what you could do in terms of your religious expression, told you in many ways how you could make a living, what you could do with your property,
the whole, as all aspects of life were controlled by absolutist edict. And I think that we sometimes tend, I know I do, to think of the Revolution and the early American experiment as a solely political event. It was just a self-government versus a king. It was much bigger than that, and Jefferson knew that and articulated it, I think, quite brilliantly. He knew that if the life of the mind was not fully engaged in political life, then the covenants we needed, the habits of mind and heart and soul, if you will, needed to be linked to, driven by reason, not revelation, not superstition. We had to, there were things to learn, there were discoveries to be made, there were mysteries to unlock, and why wouldn't there be, and why wouldn't he believe that, given what had happened in the first, in the previous 200 years? Gutenberg, the Protestant Reformation, this idea that there was, in fact, an individual capacity to practice your own religion, to seek your economic well-being, pursuit of happiness, pursuit of property, the debate with Locke and all that, to control your own destiny, ideally. And 300 years before, it wouldn't have been a conversation that would have made any sense to anyone. So what Jefferson was doing was trying to make that leap. And he encountered those Enlightenment ideas at William and Mary in Williamsburg. He had a wonderful teacher named William Small, who was a Scottish layman. They barely overlapped. We were very lucky, I think, in that sense. And a republic would only survive by the character of the people. And the character of the people, if they were free-thinking and had the capacity and the awareness that there were discoveries to be made, would be more likely to be independent-minded and resist the great fear, the consuming fear of Thomas Jefferson's life, which was the return of a king. You cannot understand the early American Republic, I believe, without understanding the total consuming concern of Jefferson and Madison in particular, that a monarchy was always 20 minutes away. And that if the republic could not grow strong quickly, then there was no hope but that it would collapse. Now, Washington, among others, believed that Thomas Jefferson was a paranoid. President Nixon taught us an important lesson. Even paranoids have enemies. The thing about Jefferson's fears, and an argument I make in the book, which is that we need to look at the end of the French and Indian War to the end of the War of 1812 as a 50-year war, not unlike, it's an imprecise analogy, but not unlike the Cold War that lasted from Truman through George H.W. Bush, where the threat of the Soviet Union drove domestic politics. It was sometimes hot, sometimes cold, sometimes took foreign expression, sometimes didn't, but was always there. The fear of Britain was always there. And the wonderful thing about this argument is they did come back. So they burned the White House, they declare war on us again, we had to have a ratifying conflict in 1812. So it's a fun argument to make since one wins it, which is always nice. Not always happens. So these Enlightenment ideas, finding political expression, totally critical. The other thing, and this does resonate, I think, a lot now, is not only did citizens have to be intellectually curious, reasonable as opposed to superstitious, but we had to, you and I, had to like each other, at least a little bit. We had to be sociable, as the great Gordon Wood put it, because if we weren't connected one to another, what on earth would enable us, make us, to offer the mutual concessions of opinion necessary to make a democratic republic work? Why would I give up my 5% so that somebody else's kid could go to school if I didn't believe that my fate ultimately was linked morally, politically, and practically with everyone else's. And if we didn't know each other, we would be less likely to make those sacrifices. It is best to give as well as to take in a system such as ours, said Jefferson. Without harmony and affection, this life would be a rude thing indeed. I slightly got that wrong, but that's from a paraphrase of the first inaugural. Without the harmony and affection, without which life would not be worth living. This takes political expression for him in the way he governed. He always wanted to have people down to dinner as president. He, again, this sounds like one version of hell, but every night during the congressional session, he would have gatherings of lawmakers, not Republicans and Federalists. This was not a kumbaya attempt. He didn't think that that would work. What he wanted was to weave attachments to himself. And so it would be all Republicans one night, all Federalists the next. What happened was, and as observers pointed out, was that people became less likely to criticize the administration's measures the longer and the more often they were around Jefferson. Now, on a human level, that's absolutely what my experience teaches me. I know that it's easiest to say no in writing. It gets a little trickier on the phone, and it gets really hard face-to-face, right? And so it's one of the reasons summits are so dangerous. You know, FDR used to be terrified when Churchill would fly to Moscow to see Stalin because they'd drink too much and cut up Poland, you know. There's a wonderful story. Churchill, as he put it once, was breakfasting off aspirins on the way back, trying to remember exactly which country he'd given away. We have to watch these things. Politics is not clinical. Politics is human, but statecraft needs a certain distance. But you have to know each other. We have to care about each other, or it's not going to work. And if it doesn't work, guess what? We better hope that we get a king who agrees with us all the time. It's kind of unlikely. So, to my mind, that's a strong brief for Jefferson's contributions to the life of the nation intellectually, politically. His political career is known to all of us pretty well. But it was a unique contribution to try to translate these values into concrete cultural and political expression. Now, the worst of us. He was a slave owner by inheritance, by acquisition, but he perpetuated and protected the institution. From the first moment of his life, his first memory as a child was of being put on a pillow and being handed up to a slave on horseback who was going to take him on a family journey. One of the last things we know happened to him is that he was in his alcove bed in Monticello. He was uncomfortable. He's trying to signal to his white family who are around him what's wrong. No one gets it except an enslaved butler who reaches over and immediately fixes the pillow. And he's comfortable again. From the beginning to the end, his life is made possible by this. He benefited politically from the 3/5 clause. He was called the Negro president by his opponents. He was attacked for his connection to Sally Hemings. The first major story about that appeared in September 1802. September 1802. He had not been president for 2 years. And the story was pretty damn accurate. There are two details that were a little off. So these things were very evident in his life. So there's no excusing Jefferson and slavery. There's no apologizing for it. There is some explaining that I think is interesting and potentially illuminating. One is, as a young man, he tried on 4 or 5 occasions to reform the institution. As a trial lawyer, he made a natural law argument. He tried in the Virginia legislature. He wrote some very tough passages. as you know, in the Declaration of Independence that were taken out by others on the floor of the Continental Congress. And most significantly, in 1784, in his version of the Northwest Ordinance, he prohibited the spread of slavery to the Northwest. All of those efforts lost publicly and irredeemably, in his view. And there are two things politicians hate most, and that's losing publicly and irredeemably. And so he did something that was quite un-Jeffersonian. He gave up. He just gave up. Decided not to pursue it again because he did not believe he could find a politically viable way forward. Now, you cannot have this both ways if you're me. You cannot argue that he is the great politician of the early republic, that he was in office for 40 years, he from 1800 to 1840 for 36 of those years, Thomas Jefferson himself or a self-described Jeffersonian was president of the United States. He had the political wherewithal, if anyone did, to at least try something. It may not have passed. It took 40 years after he died and 600,000 American casualties before we adjudicated slavery. It then took a century after that in my native region for us to do things as fundamental as allowing African Americans to vote. In the lifetime of many, many of the people in this room, in the American South, segregation was an accepted reality. So I'm not defending Jefferson on slavery, but I do want to offer this as a thought. And I owe an intellectual debt to Arthur Schlesinger for this phrase. Arthur used to say that self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap. It's quite easy for us to wag our finger at the past. Makes us feel a lot better. Takes our mind off, perhaps, problems in our own time, issues in our own time that bear addressing. History teaches us, the human animal, the experience of the human animal teaches us that one generation's accepted truth is another generation's unquestionable evil. And often it's a generation or less. So my sense of the moral utility of history is not to absolve or denounce people in the past for what they did in the past. We assess what it is, we learn what we can, and what can we learn from that? My sense is that the lesson we should take from Jefferson and slavery, from America and slavery, because he was not the only catcher in the rye between abolition and slavery, is a heightened awareness of what issues there are in our own time that require our attention and our moral recovery. And whether I'm not going to name any examples, but I'm going to lay out in a couple of sentences just a test. It's a fun parlor game. Are there issues right now confronting the United States of America in which a moral case is being made for a certain course of action, and yet the majority of politically active people, for reasons of convenience, do not wish to answer that moral call or recognize the urgency of that problem? There are a couple, right? We could spend the rest of the night, I think. We won't. But just when one is tempted to huff and puff about century-old sins, let's just find a use for that self-righteousness and maybe turn it into righteousness, which is not a bad thing. Thomas Jefferson is the one founder I can imagine hanging out with a little bit, having a drink with. I was lucky enough, Monticello allowed me to spend the night in his bedroom one night. It was not as active as, you know, it might have been. I say that quickly. And what I wanted to hear the clocks and see, because everything's all original to the house.
And one of the things I realized at dawn was that as the sun comes up, his rooms face east. And so his rooms would fill with light before any other part of the house. Later that day, surely by happenstance, I was down at the cemetery and realized that at least on that day, the rays of the sun, the last place the sun was shining on the mountain, was on his grave. From the beginning to the end, he wanted to absorb, live energetically, and create something that we would be talking about and trying to improve. He was the architect of a politics of hope and optimism that every great American leader has mastered. Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Ronald Reagan, all spoke in a Jeffersonian vernacular about present pain not being simply sacrifice for sacrifice's sake, but an investment. That's one thing I think our politics needs more of, is a politics of optimism. Second thing is I do think, by pretty common assent, the current capital culture in the United States is not as sociable as it might be. No one speaks to each other, for instance. And so there is something to this. And it's not, it's not that compromise itself is a virtue. Just getting a deal for the sake of a deal. The middle way is not always the right way. But you know what? 7 times out of 10, it probably is. And the document drafted in this city made it essentially necessary that if we want anything to happen, it's going to have to happen over a long period of time and not for very long. The Constitution of the United States was written to contain our arguments more than resolve them. So being more sociable, reaching out more. And the last is I do believe that Thomas Jefferson, for all of his revolutionary rhetoric, for his flights of excessive, eminently quotable, no founder is better at needlepoint pillow quotations. Due respect to Mr. Franklin, Dr. Franklin. But that would be close. That would be an interesting battle y'all could do for a fundraiser. You know, how many, you know. I don't know if I'll offer that up. What the legacy of Jefferson, particularly his presidency, is that he would, as long as the existence of the country, the existence of this experiment was not compromised, he would cut virtually any deal. And so his principled pragmatism was that the survival of the country was paramount above all. But as we saw in Louisiana, July 2nd, July 3rd, 1803, letter comes, France wants to sell Louisiana, Jefferson's thrilled. Just immediately he begins preparing to amend the Constitution to make this happen. August 21st, 22nd, he gets another letter saying that Napoleon is rethinking what is the worst real estate deal in history. And by the 23rd of August, Jefferson has written a letter saying, in what I think of as his Claude Rains moment, he is shocked to think that anyone thought that we would need a constitutional amendment, that we must not let constitutional subtleties get in the way of progress. Like a lot of people I think we could name, he was a ferocious small government conservative unless he was in charge of big government. A lot of people call that hypocrisy. It is. I also call it human. Because he had such a great box office, I want to give Lincoln the last word tonight. In 1859, he was invited to deliver a Jefferson birthday address in Springfield. He was in Springfield, couldn't do it. So he wrote a letter about Jefferson. Specifically, the text was, "All men are created equal," in honor of the Declaration. And here's what Lincoln wrote. "All honor to Jefferson, to the man who, amid the struggles of a concrete struggle for national independence, had the coolness, forecast, and capacity," I love that, "the coolness, forecast, and capacity to insert into a merely revolutionary document a timeless truth, timeless abstract truth, applicable to all men and at all times, that today and in all coming days, they should be a very stumbling block to the signs of reappearing tyranny and oppression. Not a bad legacy. Thank you all very much. Okay.
Hi, my name's Andy. I'm director of Author Events. A lot of familiar faces tonight, so most of you know how this works. Please raise your hand. I'll call on you. Wait for the microphone. Yes, gentleman right here.
Thank you, and thank you for the talk.
Thank you, sir.
This is a question not about the slavery issue, but given Jefferson's fear of a powerful national government, and given the fact that the Constitution, which was constructed with Madison, to in effect create deadlock in Washington, if he were alive today, what would his affinity be to the Tea Party?
No, whoa. Well, I think if he were alive today, he would have a vineyard in Napa, running a bed and breakfast. To the Tea Party. This is what's so wonderful about Jefferson and what's so confounding about him. Because you and I know that we could sit here and probably swap 8 to 10 quotations, evenly split between the cause of order and stability on one hand, quite Hamiltonian, and classic Tea Party, even secessionist kind of rhetoric. I was in the airport the other day, and the man in a T-shirt had a silhouette of the state of Texas and the word secede, and I couldn't tell which side he was on. Right. Was it a cry or a command? And I didn't think of that until I was on the plane, so I couldn't ask him. One of the things that happens when you write 22,000 letters over 84 years eloquently is that, and you change your mind a lot, as I think respectable people do, sensible people do, is you can be used for all sorts of purposes. Jefferson has always been used for all sorts of purposes. Merrill Peterson wrote a whole book about this called The Jefferson Image in the American Mind. I think right now, if we play this all the way through, Jefferson is probably a symbol and a battlefield for our ongoing cultural struggles over the legacy of slavery. And that's fine. It is interesting, if you're a biographer, which is what I do, that so much is put on one person. You know, no one says that, you know, no one really wants to get right with Alexander Hamilton. You know, no one says, as James Parton, the 19th century biographer of Jefferson, wrote, if America is right, then Jefferson is wrong. If America is right, then Jefferson is right. If America is wrong, then Jefferson is wrong. Nobody says that about John Adams. Nobody says that about George Washington. So what is it about this man, of all these figures, that continues to draw us back to him? And my argument is I think we see the best we can be in him, and I think we see what we all too often really are, and that's what fascinates us.
Another question. Gentleman about 7 rows back in the middle here. Then there was one on this side. Yeah, that fella's next.
One of the things I think we know about Jefferson and Burr is that they tied in the Electoral College. What can you tell us about their personal relationship, the dealings that they had, and how they ended up being in that anomalous position?
Well, you know, Burr was absolutely essential to Jefferson's election. Burr was the Republican boss, essentially, of New York. He was the James Carville of New York in that era, and produced a Republican victory. So that so scared Alexander Hamilton, who had moved back to New York and was practicing law, that when Burr was part of masterminding a series of Republican victories in the state legislature in New York in early-ish 1800, early to mid 1800, before the presidential election, and the state legislature played a critical role, obviously, in sending electors, in the choice of electors to send to Washington. And so Hamilton writes Governor John Jay and says, I think it would be wise for us to choose the electors now, retroactively, basically, before the new Congress is seated. Jay writes on the letter, this is, I'm paraphrasing, this is so awful, I'm not even going to respond, and puts it away. So Burr was a huge political asset to Jefferson. Where the relationship totally collapsed was Burr simply let the possibility that he might prevail in the House of Representatives. Remember, this was where the vice president and the president, it just was a mistake. And all Burr had to do to end it was say, I won't serve. Guess what he didn't say? So you have this wonderful, I love it. I mean, if for super high-protein dorks, and there may be one or two here, the election of 1800 is fabulous because it's 36 ballots in the House. They carry Joseph Nicholson of Maryland in on a stretcher. His wife is moving his finger on the thing. Snowstorms are hitting. It's the apocalypse. It's just great. Adams is grumpy, the whole thing. That's redundant. I know. Never gets old. The other thing I say about Hamilton is at least my guy didn't get shot in Jersey. Take that, David Brooks. Because he did not wholeheartedly support Jefferson in that moment, Jefferson virtually didn't speak to him, really. They had dinner, he was around, but by 1803, I want to say, check me on the date, Burr is coming to Jefferson looking for preferment, looking for some other office because he knows he won't be vice president again. And then, of course, there's the treason trial and, so John McCain is not the only person who's had trouble with vice presidents going rogue. Come on, guys.
Back here on our right.
I know it's after supper, but you can do it.
In general, how did...
Where are we? There we are.
There we go.
Hi.
Ben Franklin get along with Jefferson?
You know, Jefferson so revered him that I don't think there was a... I think it was almost a religious experience. I think Jefferson worshipped Franklin. He was a little... Jefferson was as sexually driven a man as ever drew a breath, but he was sort of put off by the overt nature of the French flirtation, the culture of French flirtation when he first got there. It was basically just all the women hanging on Franklin. He was a little, and then he figured, hey, maybe this is a pretty good job. Again, hypocrite and human. You decide. It's actually kind of a sadness to me that they weren't closer, that there wasn't more. They could have had a correspondence like the Adams-Jefferson correspondence, but generationally and because of Franklin was gone, had left the country for most of Jefferson's early career, we don't really have that. But Franklin is the only person who rivals Jefferson in the panoply of talents. Benjamin Rush was great, but Franklin and Jefferson were able to do something that so few people can do, which is connect the life of the mind with a political intelligence that really made a difference.
Leave it to the right.
both Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson felt that to have a successful democracy, you had to have an educated populace. And while their views on education were different, what do you think either man's reaction would be to the destruction of public education in this country now?
Well, I think it's a wonderful question, and it's one of the anachronistic questions that one can answer, because the spirit, you can identify a similar spirit as opposed to a specific policy proposal, which you can't do. But it's the spirit of Jefferson and Franklin on the question of republican virtue, lowercase r, was so consuming that without education, without the sociability, without an economy that created the means for there to be a reasonable pursuit of happiness, the system wasn't going to work. And it's quite arguable, it seems to me, that the crisis in public education in the United States over the last 50 years, I want to call it, is a fundamental threat to the kind of democracy that over two and a half centuries, we seemed to decide we wanted to be. You know, if the characteristic of the United States at our best is that we are stronger when we open our arms wider, we are capable of those mutual concessions of opinion, and that we can guarantee equality of opportunity but not equality of outcome, that's kind of the American dream, right? And that is under assault. It's under, and I would argue that, having said I wouldn't mention one, I would argue that one of the issues that I would hope our awareness about failures in the past would arm us to attack in the present would be income inequality and its attendant discontents and ill effects. And public education is an enormous part of that.
I see a lot of hands, but unfortunately we only have time for a couple more questions. There's a lady about five rows back here in the middle.
I'll tell you a quick story about keeping answers shorter. I was one the first time I was, maybe the only time, I was on Larry King years ago now. There was, for some reason, I was doing a political segment right after some terrible tragedy had happened, and a mother had lost part of her family. I don't know if it was a tornado, I can't remember. And Larry was going to do two segments on that and then do mine. And I was just sitting there because it was remote, the tragedy one. And after the first one, you know, and people are crying and it's, you know, awful. After the first one, during commercial, Larry King said to the lady on the remote, "Hey, lady, we're sorry for your trouble, but keep your answers shorter." So I direct that to myself. It's a true story.
And I'll struggle to keep the question short.
I know. And of course, telling that story, it doesn't take up any time.
But to follow on the question about education, you said...
Where are you? There you are. Hi.
Early on, you said that Jefferson struggled with balancing the value of the noble and the open arms.
Yep.
And that seems to me another way of saying about access to education and opportunity.
Sure.
But it applies now in a very perverted way. And I wonder, in the sense of not nobility, but hierarchy. And I wonder if you'd comment on how Jefferson would have tried to address that if he were in office now.
How would he address inequality? Is that...
The tension between an elite, the value of an elite, whether it's
have
educational...
And have and have nots in terms of money and of power. You know, he and Adams, it's worth going to look. He and Adams exchange a number of letters on natural aristocracy versus hereditary aristocracy. Adams was always trying in that great
correspondents late in life to refight their political battles, and Jefferson never wanted to. So Adams would write about that, and Jefferson would write back about his vineyard. And then Adams would write back again, and Jefferson would write back about his corn. But there is an interesting argument, and they finally decide we're never going to agree on this. And Jefferson says, we cannot be like Priam of old, buckling on the armor of party once again. A very elegant way out. Jefferson, in many ways, was all about elegant ways out, by the way. My sense is that a Jeffersonian spirit would lead one to look at the issues of the early 21st century and worry about the success and survival of democracy as we have come to define it, as we were just talking about, of equality of opportunity, but not equality of outcome. And it's the equality of opportunity that is under most fundamental assault. And that would drive him crazy.
Gentlemen, in the center aisle on about 10 rows back, and we'll end there. Keep going back. He's in blue with a yellow tie. Blue and blue. Four more rows back.
Thank you. How do you think Thomas Jefferson would react to the people who are strictly construing him on the Supreme Court?
Well, now let's be clear. He wasn't around for the Constitution. I had somebody ask me the other night. I don't know where. It was like being asked by... It was kind of a birther thing in a way. It was, why did Thomas Jefferson run away from the Constitutional Convention? I was like, well, he'd been in France for 5 years, you know. But the founding documents, original intent. You know, this one I can answer pretty directly. He would be utterly flummoxed by it. Because he talked about how a constitution, asking a constitution not to change, having a constitution not change is like asking a man to wear a child's coat. And he believed that, you know, we should blow everything up every 20 years. This was when he was really drinking too much. Could it have been September 89, right before he comes back? I think so. He writes the Earth Belongs to the Living letter to Madison, which is a call for total anarchy. All law should expire after 20 years. We wouldn't be at a fiscal cliff. We all live on the Grand Canyon. I mean, it would just be like that. So everything would expire, and we would all do it again. It was his most Paine-like, Thomas Paine-like versus Burke, Hamilton-like moment. And Madison did all he could to keep it under control, but he couldn't. Original intent where you are essentially venerating and giving religious revelatory meaning and authority to a document replaces reason. And chiefly, Thomas Jefferson was about reason, and you pursue truth and you follow it, as he put it, wherever it may lead.
And unfortunately, that's where we have to end it. Please join me in thanking John Meacham. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.